Thanks, Lefty. These guys have been trying to get me on this bus ever since I've been here. I ain't getting on that bus, all right? We want to show you San Antonio. Let's get on the bus. I said, I ain't getting on the bus. No, I'm just kidding. These guys have been good hosts. I've had fun ever since I've been here. Thank you for everything you've done for me. You made me feel right at home. I thought I could stay sober with these guys. These guys are all right. My name's Joe Annis Hansel, and I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hey, Joe.
And thank you for having me back here in San Antonio. This has been an interesting year for me. I've found myself going back to places that I've been 8 and 10 and 19 years ago, and it's caused me to reflect on my life of how things have changed, like since I've been here last. Last time I spoke here, it was on a Sunday morning, and I think my plane took off like 45 minutes after I got done talking. I had to leave, and I couldn't talk to anybody, and I kind of like this. This is a good change of pace for me. Saturday morning, I feel relaxed. It's kind of nice, and I'm usually a Friday night kind of guy or Saturday night kind of guy, and this is nice. I can just let what hair I have left down and feel good and enjoy myself, and I have enjoyed myself since I've been here. I met Michael, our speaker, last night 10 years ago in Seaside, Oregon, and 2 weeks from now I'm going back to that same conference in Seaside, Oregon. I have an uncanny ability to remember things that you can't put on resumes. I remember everybody that spoke here 8 years ago, including Michael. I remember everybody that spoke 10 years ago in Seaside, Oregon, including Michael. Paul O., Judge Ray O., just right on down the line, I remembered everybody. And I think really those are the things I need to remember, because those are the things that are going to help me grow spiritually anyway. All the other stuff's foo-foo, you know. But I'm here because I want to stay sober. I don't know how many people saw that movie. My name is Bill W. You know, one of my favorite parts in that movie is when Bill goes to see Bob, and, you know, Bob's kind of skeptical, and he's going, you know, I've been prayed over. I've been rejuvenated. I've had people have me reborn and dunked. You know, it's like, what are you going to do for me? And Bill, in his own words, says, I'm not here to help you. I'm here to help myself. And once he said that, it was as if though all the defenses that Dr. Bob had just went zzz, and they talked to one another like they'd known each other their whole life. And I'm here not to help you. I'm here to help myself. So don't feel obligated to listen or agree with me, because you don't have to. Because I really don't care if you agree with me or believe anything that I have to say. I'm here to help ensure Joe's sobriety. That's why I'm here. I'm looking forward to hearing Kip and Francine. She's a fine woman. She's a classy act. I always have liked her. And I like the lineup of people that are here this weekend, just regular run-of-the-mill drunks who have tapped into a power greater than themselves that help them recreate their lives. And that's what this is all about. I heard her last night. I heard Michael last night. And I heard how she tapped into this power that helped her recreate her life. And you could hear where she come from. She came from The Walking Dead, and here she is talking about living life and enjoying herself like nobody's business. That's definitely a higher power. And each person this weekend is going to talk about how they tapped into a power greater than themselves. And that's essentially what I'm going to do. Our theme is God could and would if he were sought. And that's essentially what I'm doing today, is seeking out that power greater than myself. I'm an alcoholic because I have the illness of alcoholism, and that's really why I'm an alcoholic. There is no other mystical answer to it. Physically, I'm different when I drink. I cannot predict how much I'm going to drink or when I'm going to drink it. It makes me different from my fellows. I know a guy at work, he drinks a 12-pack a day, and he's not an alcoholic. Don, you ask him how many he drank last night, he'll say, well, I had 11. Why do you ask? Oh, wow. What'd you do with the last one? He said, it's still in the refrigerator. I mean, what's your point? Why do you want to know? And he drinks that same amount every day. Now, you and I know he would need some kind of detox or help if he were to stop. He's been drinking that way for 30-some years. But he's not an alcoholic. He can stop. He can control his drinking when he wants to. If he has an obligation to take care of with his family or friends, he'll take care of that first. Then he'll drink his 12-pack when he gets home after that. He's coached his boys' ball games. The other day he says, can you stay over and work 4 hours over till 6 o'clock? He said, I'm taking a course on signing down there at the university. He says, my granddaughter is hard of hearing. We're all going to have to learn how to sign. You think you could cover for me? I go, well, yeah. Now, do you think he went home and drank that 12-pack before he went to learn signing? I don't think so. Don's a heavy drinker. He always has been, and he's not an alcoholic. He's not like me. He can predict how much he's going to drink. When I drink, I can have 3 beers today, tomorrow have 17 beers, end up in Cleveland naked on the hood of a car. I don't know when what's going to happen. I cannot predict my drinking. It wasn't always like that. I'm one of these people that I did not grow up deprived. I didn't grow up poor. I was your average run-of-the-mill kid in a suburb in Cincinnati called North College Hill. I didn't feel like a round peg in a square hole. I didn't feel like I was socially ill-equipped to get along with people. When I started drinking, I wasn't doing it to feel whole or to change my life. I did it because the older kids were doing it. It was rather an innocent thing, and I didn't know I had the allergy to alcohol at that time. But as a young kid, I didn't find myself at any kind of disadvantage, really. You know, as a matter of fact, I think I was born positive. I was a happy, energetic, enthusiastic young kid. I was born positive. And matter of fact, I didn't have room for anybody that was negative. If I had my mind on something that I wanted to do, I went and found out how to do it. And if you said, well, you can't do that, I'd say, well, I don't have time. I'm going to find somebody who can show me how to do this. I was positive. It's the way I was created. And I had some bizarre relatives, though. I had a grandfather who used to love to drink whiskey. And he had a friend of his that would come down the street. We lived on a no outlet or a dead end street. They call them cul-de-sacs today. It was a no outlet when I was growing up. And he would come down the street with his buddy in a cab, and they were both drunk. And my dad would just go bizarre. He'd go, oh, Christ, Jubal, your father's out there. He's drunk. Go get him. He's making a fool out of himself. Jeez, you know, it was a real embarrassment to him, but it was entertainment for the kids because he would go to the trunk, and he would get a possum out on a leash. And my grandpa's out there drunk with his cab buddy walking around the neighborhood with a possum on a leash. My dad's going bizarre. Oh, Jubal, go get your father, Jesus, you know. But I didn't think anything about it. You know, I thought, well, grandpa likes to drink Echo Springs whiskey, and if you drink enough whiskey, you can get a possum. I mean, I didn't know any different. I mean, that was just grandpa. And we had a relative on my mother's side. It was her mother. She lived in a state mental institution for 40 years. And we didn't know she was alcoholic till we got sober in AA. They just kept her so buzzed out on medication. We couldn't understand her. We'd go to visit once a month or once every other month. Everybody piled into the car to go visit Grandma at the state nut house. And I didn't think anything about it. I thought everybody had a relative in the state nut house. I thought, well, there's always, everybody's got a goofball in their family somewhere. And I just didn't think anything about it. It was the way family got together and visited family. We'd go visit my aunt and uncle at their house. We'd go visit grandma at the nut house. I mean, it just, that's where they lived. I didn't really think anything about it. And it wasn't until I got older that I started to be embarrassed about other people's behavior. I'd hear other kids during the summertime, they would go to Coney Island and camping, and we'd go to state mental institutions to visit grandma. You know? But, I mean, other than that, I really didn't think much about it. You know, as a young boy, I was positive. I remember I was about 11 years old. I was in the 60s, and I remember watching Walter Cronkite, the 20th century or 21st century was. And every week they'd have something new, and then one week they had something about an incubator on there, and they'd show this one person that built this incubator and hatched all these chickens. I went, wow, I'd like to do that. I think I'm going to do that. And I told these kids at school, I'm going to build an incubator. They said, you can't do that. I go, I don't have time for you. And I found people that taught me how to do that. I built this little incubator. I hatched 21 chickens, and boom, they're all running all over the house. And that's the kind of person I was. I didn't pay attention to people say, you can't do that. I was just, if I had my mind set on something, I was going to do it. I was a lot like Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson had that attitude. And there was a little bit of I'll show you mixed in there. And this is before I drank. And everybody in my family is alcoholic. 3 out of 4 of us are sober. And at that time, Nobody's drinking was really out of hand. I mean, we were just kids. We weren't drinking yet. Mom's drinking was the first person whose drinking got out of hand. She used to drink Carling Black Label by the quarts and eat Black Mollies, Speed. And in the 50s and 60s, they prescribed Speed to women for everything, from toxemia to being overweight. And Mom would walk around drunk and blinking all the time, just like this, just always on the edge, you know. And she's about 5'2" or 5'3", and she weighed 190 pounds from drinking that beer all the time. And now I'm starting to become ashamed of what alcoholism made my mother look like. Now, I didn't know it was alcoholism. I thought it was my mother. She started looking like her mother in the state mental institution, and her mom in the state mental institution would blink a lot, too, so I thought they were nuts. And so Mom's drinking became more apparent as I got older. Dad's drinking didn't become quite as apparent because he did his drinking in the bars away from the house. So that's neither here nor there. As I got older, I joined the Boy Scouts, and I just thoroughly enjoyed that. I joined them when I was about 11 years old, and by the time I was 14, I was an Eagle Scout. I had God and Country Award in the church. I was a member of the Order of the Arrow, and all the boys that made Eagle Scout that year in Cincinnati, they had sponsors. Say if Lefty was an Eagle Scout, his sponsor would have been President of Procter & Gamble. And Elton was an Eagle Scout, his mentor or his sponsor would have been President of General Electric. And everybody in the area had some type of mentor or sponsor. And mine was President Langston of the University of Cincinnati. Now I'm 14 years old, and he calls me into his office and he said, "Did you ever think about going to college?" You know, I said, "No. I mean, I'm 14. I'm 14 years old. I don't think about going to college." And he said, "Well, if you do want to go to college and you continue to get the good grades that you're getting, please call me. Here's my card at my number at home." And he said, "When you're 16, we'll look into your grades." He said, "If you really want a college education, don't worry about money. We'll make sure you get a college education." There was a guy offering me a free college education, in other words. And I walked out of his office thinking, he really doesn't mean that. There's just no way. They don't. What are they going to do, be mean to a Boy Scout? I mean, really, they're paying him to be nice to kids like me. I don't believe that crap, all right? And that's the kind of thing that went through my mind. And at the University of Cincinnati at Corbett Hall, they had about 100 Eagle Scouts up on a stage like this, and they had a guy named General Westmoreland, Time Magazine's Man of the Year, and he was giving all these boys these Eagle Scout awards. And after the ceremony, he was talking with different individuals, and he came up to me and he said, "Have you ever thought about being an officer in the Army?" He says, "I like young men like you in my Army." I guess when you're general, you can call it your Army. And I says, "Well, no, I never really thought much about it." And he says, "Well, if you keep getting the grades that you're getting, here's this card. I want you to call this number." And he said, "Have you ever heard of a place called West Point?" And I said, "Yeah, my dad got an appointment to West Point, but he didn't go because he was a prisoner of war and he didn't want to have much to do with the military after that." And he says, "Call this number." Now, here's a general talking to a kid about a possible career in the military. Now, I know you need some kind of pull to get into West Point, and I figured general's good, you know. But I walked away thinking the same thing about what he told me as the president of the University of Cincinnati. He really doesn't mean that. They're not going to fly this general in to be mean to Boy Scouts. He's got to be nice to us. That's his job, you know. So here, something had changed in my life. I went from being positive to skeptical. And I grew up in an era that was wonderful. It was the 60s. Oh, it was wonderful. God, there was always something going on. 63, the president got killed. Wow. And then 68, his brother got killed. Wow. And then Martin Luther King got killed. Wow. You know, and they're bringing the Vietnam War into your house night after night. Walter Cronkite at 6:30. Vietnam War. They have college campus riots all over the country. Social unrest. You had a 1968 Democratic National Convention. People getting beat up all over the place. You had people going to the moon. I mean, it was one thing after another. And I'm a young kid, and I'm watching all this, and I'm looking for a place to jump in. I mean, it just seemed like things were happening all over. And I'm 13 years old, and there's this guy across the street. I'm 13, almost 14. There's a guy across the street who just got a car. And he says, "Hey, there's this girl, a senior over at the school where we go. She wants to know if you want to go to a party." I'm 13, all right? And she's 18, and I'm thinking, I am not worthy. Yeah, I'll go. I mean, do you remember when you were 13 and people were 18? They were adults. I mean, they seemed grown up. So we get in the car and go over there. It's 1967. Now, this is no slight to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is an innocent kid's journey to AA, okay? This girl's brother was in Vietnam. He's sending home pillowcases of pot in the mail once a month. Pillowcase once a month. They'd say, pillowcases in, party. And I'm going over there. I'm 13. I don't know anything. All I know is they wanted me to be at their party. I'm this skinny, almost as tall as I am now, and about 100 pounds lighter. And I'm sitting down, and they're playing all this music, and they're smoking this weird stuff, man. It looks like American flags and brown chocolate and strawberry. And I go, well, what's this? And they go, it's pot, kid, try it, you know. And believe me, I wasn't sitting there in 1967 going, this will piss them off in AA in the next century. Oh. It was what I did in 67. I was 13. Give me a break, okay? Jesus, relax. And I got thirsty. Man, my mouth is about as dry as it is right now. And I says, my tongue's sticking to the top of my mouth. And I opened my eyes, I went, wow, everything was technicolor. Look at that. I couldn't believe it. And I went into the kitchen. Come on in the kitchen, we got something to drink for you, kid. And I went in there and somebody had dropped a can opener. Now, we were all higher than a kite, and we just thought that was the funniest thing we'd ever seen. Somebody dropped a can over. We laughed 15 minutes over a can over. Ah! And the guy says, here, try it. You thirsty, kid? I go, yeah. And he gave me this bottle. It was a big bottle of Bally High wine. And I had never tasted Bally High wine. And I took a drink of that, and I said, that's like fruit punch. You ever have like a peanut butter malt or something like that, and once you start sucking on it, you just can't stop. And I just kept hitting that darn bottle of Bally High. It was one of them big ones. And they're still laughing about the can opener. I just went, you know, and before you know it, the bottle's empty. And they looked around and they go, you're supposed to pass that around. And I'm 13. I went, well, nobody told me. I had drank that whole bottle. And I heard somebody in the background go, boy, that kid can really drink, can he? And I thought, yes, I can. You know, and here I am taking credit for having an allergy I don't even know I have. And it wasn't until I came to A that I realized I had to drink that whole bottle. It went beyond just thirsty. It was, you must drink it all, and do you have more? Well, I didn't know that. I took it as a badge of honor, like, I'm with the big kids now. And you know what they said? You're a lot of fun, Joe. Come on back next Friday. And I'm looking back on it now, I was like their pet monkey. Give the kid some of this. Watch what he does. But to me, I was like, man, it's like Bill Wilson talks about in the Big Book. He felt like he had arrived. And it wasn't just the atmosphere. It wasn't just the Bally High. It was the whole thing. It was a magical moment where I felt wonderful, and believe me, I didn't become obsessed right away. I didn't say, well, I've got to have that, or gee, I can't wait to do that again. I was just impressed with how I felt like their equal, and that they wanted me to come back. That's all. That's all. And it was very innocent. It was a lot of fun, and I thought, that is really cool. They want me to come back. That was neat. And things started to take off. And by the time I'm 14 years old, some guy goes, instead of hanging out with generals and presidents, now I'm hanging around with ex-convicts. Guy, 25 years old, he goes, here, you ever try any LSD, kid? I go, no. He says, try it. I said, what's it do? He said, well, it makes you see things that aren't there. I said, it does. He said, yeah, if you take it, whatever you see, it's not there. I said, really? He said, so don't tell me about it because I can't see it. I'm seeing something else. I said, you are? He said, yeah. So I took it and I said, did you see? He goes, no, I didn't. I did that. I was weird. I did that stuff hundreds of times. You name it, I did it. And I was telling these guys, I'm so grateful I got sober before crack came out, because I would have tried it. I know I would have tried it just because they were doing it. I was an innocent young kid. Well, gee, what's that like? You know, I would not have known. I was ignorant. It was the 60s. It was the 60s, the beginning of the 70s, and it just seemed like all the kids at our age were doing that kind of stuff. But, you know, something was happening in the background, and it was alcohol. Little by little, alcohol was becoming more predominant. And I didn't even see it coming. It was blindsiding me from over here. Here I am trying to be a hippie, and I'm turning out to be a drunk. I mean, it's just weaving its way in real slow. And before you know it, I'm always drinking Annie Green Springs. I'm always drinking Boone's Farm wine. I'm always drinking MD 2020. Wow, you know, you can't freeze that stuff. I don't know what it is. We used to put MD 2020 out on the windowsill and freeze. We tried to get it to freeze. It wouldn't freeze. That's the weirdest stuff I've ever seen, MD 2020. That bottle would be cold. Stick to your hand, be so cold. You drink it, it'd go down hot. I never could figure that out. I said, well, that's pretty neat stuff. But I always found myself drinking wine, Strawberry Hill. And no matter what I was doing, no matter what the kids were introducing me to, it was alcohol. Alcohol became more predominant. And before you know it, I'm 16. And alcohol had such a hold on me by the time I was 16 years old, I didn't even know it. And I found myself in arguments with my mother. My father had stopped coming home. He had found the woman who understood. And my thinking was scrambled. My emotions were scrambled. I like the book says, I could control my emotional nature but little. And I didn't know that it was the alcohol. I had no idea. I got into an argument with my mother one time. I said, bye! Hitchhiked all the way to Florida with 9 cents in my pocket, February, no coat. Now, that's not smart. I'm an Eagle Scout. They try to teach you to be prepared, but something was wrong. I wasn't worried about it. I just went, bye! And I hitchhiked all the way to Florida with 9 cents in my pocket, February. And I got down there, and I'm working in a Chinese restaurant. I got a big afro out to here. I'm the only white guy working in the restaurant going, egg roll? And if you'd ask me, what are you doing in Florida? I'd say, well, I'm trying to find myself. Remember people in the 60s and 70s always trying to find themselves. I found myself in a roach-infested trailer park in North Miami Beach working as a busboy in a Chinese restaurant. Something happened. Something drastically happened in my life, and I didn't even know what was wrong. And I got homesick after a couple of months. Next time I went back down, ran away from home. I still have this big bush. And I got a guy with me. It's got hair down to his rear end. It's 1971. And we got arrested in Cordele, Georgia for hitchhiking. You don't want to get arrested in Cordele, Georgia for nothing. They don't like nobody that don't live there. They just, you're a foreigner. And the guy that stopped us for hitchhiking, he was a kind of heavy-set guy with mirror glasses. And he come up and he looked at me, and I had this big bush. He looked at me and says, you white or black, boy? And I'd seen that movie, Deliverance, just a month or so before that. And I said, you know what they're going to do to us, don't you? I hear that banjo playing in the background. And I said, oh, my God. I didn't know your rear end could tighten up that fast. Woo! I got to get, you know. And they were having fun with us. They had fun with these young Yankees. They were just, oh, they had a ball with us. We didn't know it, though. We were scared to death. And I found myself in situations like that sober. You know, here's the guy that was going somewhere. Here's the guy where the general says, I want you on my team. Here's the guy that where the president of the university says, I want you in my college. And here I am right there, and this guy says, I want you in my jail. I said, something has happened somewhere. I don't know what it is, but I think it's because my mother got sober. That's what it is. You know, Dad stopped coming home when Mom went to AA, and then everything just changed. It's got to be her. That's what it is. Something's wrong. It ain't me. It's got to be her. And I found myself in situations like that over and over, and the school didn't like it, and the law didn't like it, and I got in a lot of trouble. And in 1972, when I was 17 years old, you could either go into the penitentiary or the military where I was going. And I went into the military, and my dad loved that because he didn't know what to do with me, and he signed me away. And I went into the Navy thinking, well, I'll start over. You know, drunks are always starting over. I'm going to get me some kind of job and get me some kind of training. I'm going to be somebody. And I was, here I am, not knowing the whole time I'm trying to use this positive attitude. I'm trying to use my enthusiasm toward life. I'm trying to use my will to solve a problem I don't know that I have, called alcoholism. And I didn't know that that's what I was doing. I was trying to pull myself up on my bootstraps and start over. And I found myself 17 years old for the first time realizing that I need a drink in the bottom of a ship in a boiler room out in the Pacific Ocean at 17 years old. And it's the first time I ever found out I needed a drink. And needing a drink out there is a bad place to need a drink. The boiler room's about 115, 120 degrees. It never stops rolling. It's loud all the time. I'm sweating. I got people shouting out orders to me, and I think I'm going to kill somebody. You know. And I didn't know that that was, you need a drink. And it wasn't until I got out there I found out I needed a drink. And I didn't know that's what it was. I know what that's what it was now, looking back on it. It's real clear to me, and I thought, I got to get out of the Navy. I got to get out of here. I didn't know why I had to get out, but I knew I had to get out. The Navy interfered with my drinking. That's all it was to it. And it wasn't until I came to AA years later that I found out that anything that competes with the alcoholic's obsession to drink will lose. Al-Anons learn that right off the bat when they go to Al-Anon. We don't know it till years later, and we go, oh, that's what it was. And these guys that were older than me said, you can't get out of the Navy. And I thought, you watch me. Don't tell me what I can do and what I can't do. I mean, just that defiant attitude. I was still trying to use this positive outlook and enthusiasm about life to try to solve my problem, and I'm working on the wrong problem. I said, nuts. And I got out on flat feet. And there's nothing wrong with my feet. They just look flat. But I played the game to get out. And on a four-year hitch, I got out in a year and a half. And I'm home, and I'm trying to justify and rationalize to the people around me. Well, I thought you signed up for 4 years. How'd you get out in a year and a half? And here I am justifying and rationalizing in my head. And you know, we come up with answers quick. You got to come up with answers quick, because if you don't, they know you're not right. And a guy had hired me at this local plant called Millicron, and I worked there about 2 months, and all of a sudden I started drinking. I didn't show up to work for 2 weeks. I couldn't stop. And he called the house. He says, you still work here? And I says, no, as a matter of fact, I'm glad you called. I'm going to truck driving school, and I was going to come in and get my check today. I'll see you later on. Click! I wasn't going to truck driving school. What are you going to tell him? I'm drinking and I can't stop. That's why I'm not at work. You can't tell them that. They'll think you're crazy. You know, a drunk's always got to have a fast answer why they do what they do. Because they don't know why they're doing what they're doing. I always use this example because it's the best example I can think of. I passed out with my pants down around my ankles one time at a party. And no, I don't act shocked. God damn, this is AA. And this girl the next day said, why did you pass out with your pants down around your ankles? I didn't even have to think about it. I said, because I was hot. And you know what I thought? Man, I don't know why my pants were down around my ankles. But you can't tell them. You don't know. They'll think you're out of your mind, you know. And, you know, I found myself in situations like that, having to justify and rationalize and come up with quick answers because I really didn't know what was wrong with me. And I'd become violent. I was tearing my mother's house up, cussing her out in her kitchen at 3 and 4 in the morning, and punching holes in walls and throwing fans and lamps that were plugged in and on, and just throwing them across the room, and just I'd punch a door, and it would, you know how a door closes like this, I would hit it, and it would go through the door jamb through the other side. And my mother's sober at Alcoholics Anonymous, and she's watching her sons come home drunk from alcoholism like this, and she knows what's wrong with us. We don't know what's wrong with us. And she says, Joe, you have a drinking problem. I says, you're nuts. I said, you go to that AA thing, and they've got you brainwashed. They've got you believing that anybody that drinks a little bit's an alcoholic. Look, just because you can't handle your liquor doesn't mean I'm an alcoholic, so get out of my face. And I'm talking to my mother like that in her kitchen, and I'm cleaning it up. And if you drank like I drank, you know how I talked to my mother in her kitchen in her house. And she finally kicked me and my brother out. She talked to a social worker for a couple years and a sponsor who finally convinced her the best thing you can do for your sons is let them go. It's backwards of a woman's nature to not take care of her children, but they finally convinced her the best way you could take care of them is let them go. By letting us live there, she was teaching us to live off a woman, and she was also okaying the fact that we were killing ourselves on a daily basis. And it's okay, you can kill yourself, just keep coming on back. And she said, if that's okay with you, then you keep letting those kids come home, but if it's not, please do them a favor and do yourself a favor, kick them out. And I'll tell you something, one of the best things my mother ever did for me was kick me out, because when she stopped helping me, she really started helping me. I went down, whoa, fast. The second greatest thing she ever did for me is she introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I got a roach-infested sleeping room on Scott Street, but alcohol was still working for me. I had a bare mattress on the floor for a bed and a cardboard box turned upside down for an end table. I put my room key and my 6 cents, my change on my box, and I had a light that hung from a wire on the ceiling. No lampshade, no nothing, just a wire and a light. I had holes in the walls. I had roaches in the place. I had a four-pane window, and one of the panes were broken out, and the wind would tatter the plastic curtains that had grease all over the blinds. But alcohol was still working. And you know how I know it was still working? I'd come in here at 3 in the morning, and boom, I'd hit that door and turn the light on. Those roaches would scatter all over the place. Slam the door shut. I'd go over there and lay down, boom, look at that light hanging. And I'd look at the mattress. It didn't have anything on it. And alcohol would say, hang in there. We're going to get you box springs and sheets one day. But right now, you just hang in there. And I'd say, well, all right. And I'd pass out. Or I'd lay there and all of a sudden I'd feel something on my face and it'd be a roach giving you one of these. You ever have a roach give you one of them? But when alcohol's working for you, you go, boom. Alcohol says, everybody's got to have a place to live. All right. And I just go on out. Or I look over at that box, and alcohol would say, don't worry about it. It's a member of the wood family. We'll get you real wood one day. You just hang in there. And I'd say, well, all right. Alcohol was still working for me. And that's the thing about alcoholism. It makes the alcoholic like me accept less and less and less as this is normal. This is okay. You know, if alcohol is working for you, it's working for you. And it was still working for me. I remember January the 18th, 1977, I had hitchhiked across the river. I'd been down. I was over there earlier in the year. The year changed. I'm 22 years old now. And I'd hitchhiked back up to a bar I used to drink in North College Hill to hustle drinks. And the door shut. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with me anymore because I was one of those people that would do bizarre things in your car. We'd be sitting there talking about current events, and all of a sudden I'd grab the steering wheel and start doing that, and the car would be all over. The guy said, get the hell out of my car. I go, why? Man, you just almost had caused us to have a wreck. Well, I'm just kidding. I'm just playing, you know, don't take it personal. Damn. And people go, don't let him in your car. You never know when he's going to go off, and he doesn't know when he's going to go off. So the door's shut, and here I am. No hat, no gloves, Old Navy pea coat on, little memento, bib overalls on, a shirt, socks, and shoes. It's 25 below, the wind chill factor 70 below, and I'm thinking, man, I got to get back over the river and go to my room. It's cold out here, man. And I walked about a mile and a half, and somebody out of the goodness of their heart picked me up. And the next thing I know, I'm downtown Cincinnati. It's 3:45 in the morning, and the Ohio River's frozen. People walked across the river that year. And I'm walking across that bridge, and the wind's just whipping. And it not even running across my mind that the reason I'm out there is because of my drinking. I'm out there because of alcoholism. But if you'd have stopped me in the middle of that bridge and said, hey, man, what don't you think you have a drinking problem? I'd say, well, hell no, I don't have a drinking problem. I've got a transportation problem. I've got 30 cents, but the buses aren't running. What do you mean, drinking problem? Who are you? You know, I'll tell you what my problem is, my mother. That's what my problem is. Yeah, if she wouldn't have joined that AA, shoot, my mom and dad'd still be married. I'd be a college graduate by now. No, she had to go to that AA. She's nuts. Dad's right. She's crazy. I'll tell you why I'm out here. It's because I got a job in a boiler room. Boy, did I get shafted on a job in the Navy. If I'd have had a job in a radar room, whites and air conditioning, I might be a career man, you know. I know why I'm out here. It's because I have a GED. I never got a college education. It's the girlfriend that dumped me. That's what it was. That is why I'm out here. Not once did it occur to me that I was there because I had a problem with Joe and I had a problem with alcoholism. Never run across my mind. I'm sitting there, it's springtime, it's starting to warm up. I'm sitting on a little stone wall out in front of my room on Scott Street across from the laundromat, and there's people going up and down the street on Friday night, couples going out on dates. My hair's out to here, I got the Charlie Manson look. I smell like a goat, look like a goat, no clothes, I got bib overalls on with nothing underneath, and I'm watching people go up and down the street thinking, I wonder why I can't get a date. Shoot. You know, and it just, I had no idea what was wrong with me. I thought, well, if I could just get the right woman, if I could just get the right job, you know, if I just get a car that had gas and ran, I'd be doing all right. I had no idea what was wrong with me. Absolutely none. I was introduced to AA through a spiritual awakening for the first time on April the 9th, 1977. I'm 22 and I had this overwhelming spiritual experience. And the only way I can explain it is being drunk and stoned for 10 years and all of a sudden, mind as clear as it is right now. Wow, I quit cussing, I quit smoking, I mean, it was just, and something inside said, call your mother. She used to drink. Call her. And something inside said, you don't have to drink anymore. Now, I didn't know I had alcoholism, but it was almost like God said, I think he's had enough for right now. Let me introduce him to these people. And I called my mother up, and she put me on a phone with this guy, and he says, you think you might have a problem with your drinking? I says, well, I don't know, I might. I mean, I really didn't know. I was just overwhelmed with this spiritual experience. And he said, well, why don't you come on down to the meeting tonight? And I said, look, I feel like I've just gotten off this merry-go-round, and it stopped. I'm going to go back to where I live and go upstairs. We had a community bathtub. All 10 people in the building used it. I'm going to go up. I'm going to get a bath. I'm going to go home and go to bed. And I'll be down tomorrow. And that's exactly what I did. And I walked into AA on April the 10th, 1977, for the first time, I was 22 years old. Not knowing what was wrong with me, something inside says, go where your mother goes. I have hair out to here. I have no shirt, no underwear, no socks, and an old pair of worn-out earth shoes. And I walked in there, and there was a guy. Man, these people were old. When you're 22, 30's over the hill. This guy was 55. He was an engineer, and he comes over. He says, hey, Why don't you come on over here and have a cup of coffee with us? And he says, you know, I don't know if you're an alcoholic like we are, but if you are, you're in the grips of a progressive, fatal, and incurable illness. Never gets any better without spiritual relief. And I'm thinking, that might be true for you, you old fart. You drank 30 years. Your problem is you can't successfully drink. You have nowhere left to go. And then this other woman, she was real old. She was 40. Wow. You know, I'm 47. 50's mild, but back then, 40 was old. And she said, if you want to find a way up and out of your problems, Joe, we'll share with you how we did it. She did not say, we'll tell you what to do. Thank God they didn't. Because I'm spiritually dyslexic. I get things backwards. When people try to help me, it looks like they're trying to hurt me. When people don't try to help me, I see him as helping me. It's really bizarre. You talk to me about yourself, I'll listen to you all day. You start giving me instructions I never asked for, I'll tell you to bug off. And a guy got up and told his story like I'm doing now. He'd just gotten a sponsor. It was a big deal. It was advertising. Everybody, you need a sponsor. I got a sponsor. I got the best sponsor in the world. Now, it's my first day of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sitting there with no shirt, no underwear. I don't know what a sponsor is. But I started making decisions based on lies that started helping me right away. I looked at all these old people and I thought, well, they're all old. They must all be sober.
Wrong. Most of them weren't. The second lie, I believe, was, well, since they're all sober, they must all have a sponsor. Wrong. Most of them didn't. But I thought, well, I want one. I don't want to leave here without one. I don't want to be the only one here without one. Well, you know, I was neurotic. I want one. And I turned to the guy next to me after the meeting. I said, would you be my sponsor? I didn't even know what one was. And he said, yeah. He's been my sponsor ever since that day. He watched me go in and out of AA 20 or 30 times before I surrendered. But on that day, you know, the mind of an alcoholic is really warped and twisted and everything's backwards. And on that day, this guy seemed Disneyland goofy. I thought, you can't be that happy and not have something you're getting high drinking on. And in my mind, he would laugh and it would sound like, yahoo, yahoo. It's like, man, you can't be that happy. He said, you know, he said, and he told me about the stuff he did. He says, I try to go to a meeting every day, Joe. He said, I got a sponsor I talk to on a regular basis. I have a home group. He said, I have taken the steps. He said, I go to a jail meeting once a week. And he says, by the way, I read this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I try to do what it says to do. You might want to read it. And I have no underwear, no shirt on. I'm thumbing through this book, and I thought, there's not one picture in this book. There aren't anybody reading books without pictures where I'm at, where I'm living, pal. You know, and I've often said, I always thought, well, they should have had a picture of the co-founder passed out in the bathtub. You know, like a before and after picture. Like, here's Bill drunk, here's Bill sober. Check that out. I got to get some of this. But there weren't any pictures in here. And you know what I thought to myself? This guy didn't hear a damn thing I'm talking about. I need a job. I need BBDs. I need a car. And he's handing me a book. And he's going, yahoo, yahoo. I'm going, oh, man. I thought, he's nice, but he's just not in touch with reality. He can't be. And he watched me go in and out of AA. I always had these schemes. First scheme I had was, I'm going to college. I'm going to be an x-ray technician. Hell, I couldn't deal with what you could see, let alone what you couldn't. I didn't know what the hell was wrong with me. I've got bib overalls on, no shirt, no underwear. I'm going to college. And this is how we think. We don't know what the hell's wrong with, at least I didn't. It was not too long ago, there's a guy that called me from the drop-in center. That is the last stop in Cincinnati. They'll let you stay there for the night. After that, you've got to get out. And he called me and says, Joe, he said, I heard you talk the other night. I wanted to ask your opinion on something. I said, what's that? He said, well, I'm trying to make a decision whether to be a security guard at the Natural History Museum or go to college. What do you think? And I wanted to go, you know? But I said, well, it's been my experience that if you put AA first, it really doesn't matter. He said, oh, okay, click. But I could identify with him so much. This guy has nothing like I did, and he's trying to make these big decisions about his life, which has nothing to do with alcoholism at all. And after 89 days, I started drinking again. I'd go to meetings every day. I got drunk after 4 months. I'd come back. I got drunk after 5 months. I chaired a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, leave and go get drunk. I remember the one time I was sober 5 months, I chaired the meeting. I'd been sober 5 months continuously, went to a meeting every day. I walked out of the meeting. I'm walking down the street. My mind says, you know, a bottle of MD-2020 would be really good right now. And the other part of my head said, well, you're a big boy. Why don't you go get it? And I thought, well, boy, yeah, that makes sense to me. So I went and got me a bottle. I'm honking on it. I got it halfway down. I thought, you are crazy. You just went to 5 months of AA meetings and you walked, just left an AA meeting. You're drinking MD-2020. You're one of those people that are constitutionally incapable of being honest, so you're never going to get this. You're a loser. You are a loser. You're a nobody. You're a nothing. And I drank and found loneliness like I'd never found it. You know, in the dry periods, I'd gotten a room on the other side of the river, but it was still the same thing. I'm the only guy in the building under 65. There's 10 of us in the building. We all use the same bathroom. We're paying like $18 a week or something like that for room rent. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, which I hope is the last time I had to come back. And my sobriety date is October the 5th, 1978, and I had no idea that that was going to be my sobriety date. You know, we read these things in the big book as if though we can forecast or logically make decisions about our lives. And what people don't realize As this was written looking in the past tense, they looked back over the shoulder and said, just exactly what do you think we did? And that's what this is. There's no way I could sit down and say, well, you know, I've got two alternatives. It's either drink and blot out this intolerable situation and go out to the bitter end, or accept spiritual help. I think I'll accept spiritual help. It didn't happen like that. I didn't even know that's what I was doing. I didn't even know that I was realized that I surrendered and started to rely on a higher power the day that I did. But God knew what this drunk understood. He knew I understood bitterness and resentment. And he used that to help me. That's how smart my God is. I came back to AA that night, and I don't remember what was said at the meeting, but I remember my sponsor's car. I'm sitting there, and I haven't bathed in days. I have no job, no money. I smell bad. I look bad. I still got that Charlie Manson look going. And he said, I want to thank you, Joe. You helped save my life this past year. And I thought, Jesus, Disney, Goofy, come on, man, Jesus. He said, yeah. He said, I made a deal with God. And he said, I asked God to save my mom's life. And he said, you save my mom, I'll stay sober. She dies, the hell with you, the hell with AA, the hell with my sponsor, I'm drinking. And he said, she died. And I was getting ready to drink, and you drank. And I saw how it was tearing your life up. And you just made it so clear. I don't need that right now in my life. Thanks. You really teach me a lot. And you know what I thought? He's using me. This bastard's using me. And I walked away from his car that night thinking, I'll show you. I'm so sure this thing's not going to work. I'm going to do everything you do. I'm going to smoke the same cigarettes, eat the same food, go to the same meetings, read this dumb book that doesn't have a picture in it. I'm going to do everything you do. And when it doesn't work out, like everything, even AA up to this point, I could say, I told you so. You were wrong. I was right. And I've been sober ever since that day. Now, what I didn't know is I had made a decision that day to do what sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous do. Motive was not important. I was out to prove he was wrong. That's like eating a box of X-Lax to prove you won't have a bowel movement, all right? It's like, I will not. I will. Yes, I did. You know, AA is the same way. You take these steps. Once you take them, there's no turning back. You can't change your mind and untake them. They're going to do what they're going to do. And I didn't know this. I was sober 3 days, and my sponsor says, I need somebody to talk down at the jail tonight. He called my landlord. My landlord's the only person in the building has a phone. None of his other guys could afford a phone. She yells down the hall, there's some guy from Alcoholics Anonymous on the phone. I went, oh, God, they all know I'm an alcoholic now, Jesus. I was the only one in the building sober, okay? So I walked down the hall. I wanted to say, bitch, what'd you do that for? But she was an elderly woman. I went, thank you. That's exactly what I thought. And he says, I need somebody to talk at the jail tonight. I said, Mike, I've only been sober 3 days. What am I going to tell them guys? He said, why don't you tell them what it's like to be sober 3 days? I says, all right, I'll meet you down at the clubhouse. I went, click, and I went, oh, that was dumb. What did I do that for? That was stupid. So I'm on the bus, and I'm riding down. I had $1.25. I used 30 cents for the bus. I'm the only one on the bus, me and the driver. And I'm all the way in the bench seat in the back, looking all the way up the road at the bus, and he keeps looking at me in that rearview mirror. Because I didn't look right. I still didn't have a shirt on. I had hair out to here. And I'm sitting there, and I'm listening to this diesel engine going, and I'm thinking, you've lost it, man. You've lost it. You're going down to meet a guy that you don't like, who you think's Disneyland goofy, to talk to a group of guys that you don't know, to tell them what it's like to be sober 3 days. You have lost your mind. And I met him down there, and we went to the jail, and I talked for 5 or 10 minutes in there. And on the way out, he said, see, that helped you stay sober, didn't it? And I thought, you're dumber than I thought. There's not a beer in that place. Well, how can you get... God, this guy really is Disneyland goofy. But I'll tell you something that happened. And this just came back in my memory last fall. And I've been sober 23 years in October. And believe me, this never even entered my mind. But it just had a big impact on my decision. Yeah, I did this out of spite. And yeah, I was hurt. And I was upset about how my life had turned out, and I knew it wasn't going to work, because AA was just a bunch of words on paper by now. It didn't mean anything. You keep coming around AA long enough, you know the fifth chapter, you know the steps. It's all, yeah. I've heard that crap before. It doesn't mean anything. But what my sponsor did is he had me take a series of actions that made sobriety mean something. He had me do things that made this big book come alive. He knew I didn't understand the big book. He knew I was too burnt out to even try to comprehend. This thing is not rocket science. I guarantee you, if you're sober 6 months or less, if you really want to stay sober, I can make this AA thing as simple as a walk in the park for you. It's got to be simple so sick people can get well. And that's what my sponsor did. But he said something that came back to me just last year. Lefty, this blew me away, man. And if you're new here, I can make you the same promise. He sat in his car. He was going to drive me home. I hadn't got a car yet. And before he turned the ignition on, he looked at me with a rather pensive look. I mean, it just like it penetrated my soul. And he looked at me and he says, Joe, I want to tell you something. He said, I owe you this as a member of AA and your sponsor. He said, I can promise you, as sure as we're sitting here, that if you make AA and staying sober the most important thing in your life, you will never have to worry about money. You will never have to worry about a job. You will never have to worry about a relationship. You won't have to worry about where you live. It will all be taken care of for you. I promise you. And I looked at him, and for about 5 seconds, I believed him. And all of a sudden, 5 seconds later, my mind said, let's go, man. I got laundry to do, all right? Come on. I got to be in by 10. But there was a split second where I believed him, because I thought, this guy can't get anything from me. I don't have anything for him to hustle. I don't have the money. I don't have any car. I don't have a job. There was no reason for him not. I get chills talking about it. In 30 days sober, I wrote that inventory because I was nuts. I went through the 12 steps 30 days sober. I was trying to prove it wouldn't work, but on the other hand, he promised me. And I believed him. I didn't see this till last year, I swear to you. And I went through these steps, and I wrote that crap down. It was crude. It wasn't exactly like the big book. You know, in the 70s, very few people that I was around talked about the big book. They said we were fanatics, or big book thugs, or whatever you want to call it. And then in the 80s and 90s, all of a sudden they had big book seminars. And people were walking up and going, do you know how many musts there are in the big book? Do you know how many times the word honest is used? It's like, no, why? You know, it was almost like it became an intellectual contest instead of a way of life. I had people come up to me and give me these papers, and they look like computer flow charts. I said, what is this? They said, it's a guide to the fourth step. It's like, two resentments equal an ego squared and one guilty. I don't know. It's, whoa, man, if I had to do that, just get me some MD. I hurt my head looking at that. I said, you need a guide to the guide? Well, yeah, that's what so-and-so and so-and-so said at this seminar. I go, oh, no, it's not that hard. I said, I don't think Abby handed Bill an outline. I don't think Bill handed Bob an outline. They shared their lives. They shared with another person exactly what they did. And I wrote down, I said, Mike, what do I write? He says, resentment, fear, and sex, the things that make you angry, the things you make you squirm when you think about, and your sex life. You know, the stuff you were never going to tell anybody. He said, you write that down. So I wrote all that stuff down, and I read it to him. You know, it's no big deal. And I guarantee you, if you look at this, you'll never think of the inventory different ever again after this meeting. I promise. You know, people look at the example of the inventory on 65 and they go, well, it's, you know, you got to have the columns and it's got to be just right. I don't know. I'll tell you a little bit about my sex life. I thought I'd never tell anybody about the buffalo from Billings, Montana. It was rather embarrassing. And I found out in AA, everybody's got a buffalo. Some of them are willing to admit it, and some of them aren't.
Well, let me ask you this. If something as embarrassing as that buffalo, does it really matter what column the buffalo's in? I don't think so. What matters is you write down about the buffalo. Well, where were you at fault? I lied to the buffalo. I love you. Greatest lie I ever told anybody for sex. I always lied to get sex. I never thought anybody wanted to have sex with me. Unless I lied. And the greatest lie of all, I love you, created terrible problems and jealousy and bitterness and resentment. Terrible. But you see what I'm saying? Does that buffalo really matter what column that's in? No. You know what matters is I write that stuff down and I tell somebody about it. It's not so much the form, it's the content. It's what's in that inventory. It's the things that are eating my lunch up. It's the things that are keeping me awake at night when I lay down and I think, oh God, I stole that money and they find out. The example here is real easy. Forget the columns. Just forget the columns. We were usually as definite as this example. These are the things he's mad at. He's mad at a lot of people. I'm resentful at Mr. Brown. Why? His attention to my wife. Told my wife of my mistress. May get my job at the office. Well, how does it make you feel? I want to kill him. That's how it makes me feel. I'm going to kill him. Well, they use words like it affects my self-esteem. Well, I guess you don't feel too well when you're thinking about killing somebody. I mean, aren't some things kind of self-explanatory? It affects my sex life. It affects my security. Mrs. Jones, he's mad at her, too. He's mad. She's a nut. She snubbed me. She committed her husband for drinking. He's my friend. She's a gossip. Well, how do you feel about her? I'm going to kill her, too. My employer, unreasonable, unjust, overbearing, threatens to fire me for my drinking and my expense account. I'm going to kill him, too. And here's a good one. I'm mad at my wife. I am resentful at my wife. Why? Misunderstands and nags. Likes Brown. Wants house put in her name. How does that make you feel? I'm going to kill both of them. You see what I'm saying? Does it really matter what column all that anger's in? Does it really? No. What matters is I hate her. I hate him. I hate them. And I'm going to kill them all. And hopefully you have a sponsor that will enable you to see that all these things were nothing but excuses to drink. We had to justify why we were drinking the way we're drinking. I'm drinking because she wants the house, that witch with a B. You know what I mean? I'm just drinking. It's my employer. It's all those things I told you about I was thinking about on the bridge. The Navy. The GED. My girlfriend. It's all of them. It's not the form. It's the content. If you're new, whatever's bothering you, be specific, write it down, tell somebody, tell on yourself. If you can see where you're at fault, fine. If not, don't worry about it. Nobody does this thing perfect. I couldn't see where I was at fault at anything on my first inventory. My sponsor says, can you see where you're at fault? I said, about what? I was so sick, I couldn't. He had to use an example in his own life to open up the door for me. And when he said, well, I found in this area, it was my attitude toward this. I went, wow, I never thought of that. You think maybe that's it with me? He says, I don't know. It's your inventory. I can't tell you. He was shrewd. He knew. But he took me through the steps in such a way where it made the big book come alive. It brought me in contact with a power greater than myself. What I didn't know was, is that God could and would if he were sought. And that's exactly what I was doing. I was seeking out a power greater than myself the whole time. And in my sick mind, I'm thinking, I'll show you this doesn't work. I'll show you. I'll prove to you this doesn't work. And I'm relying on this power. My life unfolded. It really unfolded. I got about 10 minutes here. I got married when I was sober a couple years to a fine gal. I'm still married to her today. I apologize. I know in AA it's usually 3, 4, 5 marriages, but I can only get the hang of one. I'm kind of retarded when it comes to stuff like that. She's been a member of Al-Anon since 85. Thank God for Al-Anon. If it wasn't for Al-Anon, I wouldn't be married right now. I guarantee you that. My wife had 2 boys, a year apart on the same day. I don't know if that was good timing or bad memory, but I said, whatever it is, you better knock it off, because I can't handle every year on November 20th. And they're some fine kids. They really are. They're good kids. And I'm going to tell you this. I was so worried about, am I going to be able to take care of these kids? They're 17 and 18 years old now. And it just seemed like yesterday, I'm going to my sponsor. Am I going to be able to take care of these kids? Am I going to be able to provide for them so they grow up? And he goes, oh, Joe, he said, Jesus. He says, you don't ever have to worry about that. I said, why? He said, your children are going to grow up in spite of you, not because of you. And I thought, that's easy for you to say. You don't have kids. But he's right. And it's really weird how kids turn out. It's a roll of the dice. It really doesn't matter how good you practice AA. It doesn't matter if you're a drunk parent or a sober parent. God doesn't really need much of your help. He just wants you there to watch. And I know that to be true because our boys are like night and day. They're just completely different from one another. I was sober a couple years. I learned how to fly a plane. I got a pilot's license, and it was just fun flying. I couldn't believe a guy like me was doing stuff like that. We bought a house. We've been living in the same house for 17 years now. I've been with the same employer for 22 next month. And all these things I'm talking to you about is because I had sought out a higher power, not knowing that's what I was doing the whole time. I didn't know. My sponsor's always been big on enjoying your life. You know, after I did the steps the first time, he says, man, go enjoy your life. You're free. And I says, I know something's different about me. He says, why? I says, I don't even want to drink. He said, that's what AA does. It removes the obsession and renders the sufferer happy, whole, and useful. He said, that's what it does for us. He said, it's amazing. All the bottoms in AA are the same. Michael talked about the four horsemen. The frustration, terror, bewilderment. Just all our bottoms, the tops are different. As a result of relying on this higher power, the highs are different. Everybody does different things in life. And he says, find something you like and go have fun. Enjoy your life. And I've been doing that ever since. I've been staying active, and AA's been number one in my life ever since I started staying sober this last time. In 98, well, when I was here 8 years ago, I had no idea this stuff was going to happen. In 98, I took my oldest boy, who was 14, to East Central Africa to Kilimanjaro, to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. And people said, well, why'd you do that? I said, well, hell, I've already been to Gatlinburg. I figure I'd try that. And we went over there, and you never know how AA is a part of your life until it shows up and you realize how relying on this power greater than yourself has become an intricate part of your everyday thinking and your waking moments. We didn't quite make it to the top because he got altitude sickness, and we walked about 9 miles that day, and we walked the same 9 miles back down. And he could tell he was kind of disappointed. And along the way, I says, you just keep talking to me. You're going to be all right. He says, I don't want to talk to you. I says, I really don't care what you want. Just keep talking to me. You know, loving father that I am. And I said, let me ask you something, Mike. I said, if you'd have known last year you weren't going to make it to the top, would you have come? He said, probably not, Dad. I said, really? He said, yeah. I says, well, let me get this straight. You would have missed seeing Amsterdam. You would have missed seeing Nairobi. You would have missed seeing the Maasai warriors out on the Serengeti Plain and those wonderful people of the Chuga tribe. You would have missed seeing this wonderful, wonderful landscape in Kilimanjaro, all because you weren't going to get to the top. I says, I owe this to you as your father. And you might not remember, and it might not mean anything to you. I says, but sometimes life's not about getting to the top. Sometimes life is about being happy on the side of the mountain where you're at. And you know where I heard that? I thought, where'd a wino learn to talk to a kid like that? About 6-7 years before that, my sponsor at an AA meeting, we were talking about how there is no place where everything is wonderful all the time. He said, it's like being on the side of the mountain. Sometimes you're going up, sometimes you're going down. But AA is about learning how to be comfortable on the side of the mountain where you're at. Little did I know, years later, that would pop out of my mouth on the side of a mountain in East Central Africa with a 14-year-old kid. I didn't know that 8 years ago when I was here. This past summer,
I always wanted to do something with my youngest boy. He was born with club feet, and he had lots of surgeries and stuff, and he couldn't do what me and Mike did. Now, I always felt kind of bad about it, but I thought, well, he'll let me know. He's very smart, takes German in school, and gets straight A's. He said, I'd like to go to Germany. I said, let's do that. So a year out, we started planning on how to do that. We got rail passes and all that. And I thought, oh, God, what am I going to do with his mother and his brother? Geez, I got to do something. I can't leave them out, you know. So what we did was this. My wife and my oldest boy started in Paris, and me and Bob started in Zurich, Switzerland. And our plan was to travel 9 days, and we would all meet the last 4 days in The Hague in the Netherlands. Well, they said, we're going to spend 3 days in Paris, and we're just going to wing it from there. We don't know where we'll be. We'll meet you there in the Netherlands. I said, fine. So me and Bob were having a good time in Zurich and Interlaken and Lucerne, and we went to Munich. We went to the Hofbrauhaus, and we saw the Dachau extermination camp. We went to Stuttgart, and then we had a couple of days to kill before we were supposed to meet my wife and my oldest boy. I said, well, Bob, where do you want to go? He said, Dad, when you and Mike went to Africa, me and Mom, we stayed in Amsterdam. We went to Brussels for the day, and I want to take you to Brussels. He said, it's really neat. I says, okay. So we're riding the train along the way. And along the way, he says, let's stop in Cologne, Germany. I says, why? He said, there's a cathedral there I saw when I was here a few years ago. He said, I want you to see it. So I says, okay. We got off the train. We walked around for a few hours. It was a wonderful thing to see. We hopped back on the train. We're riding for a few hours. I said, Bob, I'm looking at this map here. There's a little town called Bruges in Belgium. It's a lot closer to where we're going to go to meet your mom and your brother. Why don't we go there? That way when we leave, we won't have as far to go on the train. He says, okay. So we get off. There's no currency exchange. I've got these German marks. I can't even get a cab. I can't even get a bus or a tram or, oh, what are we going to do now? And I thought, well, I'll talk one of these cabbies into taking us down to a bank and we'll change the money over. And that's what happened. And we went and got a place, and we're a block away from the square, and there are thousands of people there in July and August. I mean thousands. And they've got the marionettes there with the puppets entertaining the kids, and they've got Chinese contortionists all folded up and stuff, you know, and people were throwing money in a basket. And it was just, it was too much for your senses. It was just overwhelming. And I says, you know, I really miss your mother and your brother. I said, I really wish that we could see them. And he said, well, God, Dad, look at all these people. There's thousands of people here. How would you ever pick them out even if they were here? I said, well, I'm just thinking out loud. I miss your mom, Bob. So we took a little break in this alleyway, and this alley has got these little parks and stuff in the alleys. We watched people for 45 minutes, and we went to eat at a sidewalk cafe. And the cafes are all facing in where there's thousands of people. And I'm eating a bucket of mussels, and he's eating a bucket of mussels, and all of a sudden I get up to pay, and I walk up to the maitre d', and I hear somebody say, hey, Killer Joe. That's my nickname. I don't have time. And I looked over in the square, and there was my wife, and there was my oldest son. And I looked at Bob, and I says, we didn't have to pick them out. They picked us out. And I'm going to end with this. We didn't know where we were going to be. What are the odds of a family of four, two people, meeting in a city they'd never been in all of Europe? They didn't have a good time in Paris. They left early. They came to that city of Bruges and spent 4 days. They were lonely for us, and they thought we would went to the Netherlands. They went looking for us in the Netherlands. They spent the night in Amsterdam. They were going to ride back, and they were delayed 5 hours by a gas leak on the train line. And they finally got back, and they checked into the place they were before, and they were tired, and they slept, and they got up, and they were walking down to the square, and Mike said, let's go up this street. We've never been up this street before. And there we were. And I say this to you. We were supposed to be there. Had me and Bob not stopped at the church in Cologne, our paths never would have crossed. Just think if they would have had a currency exchange. Was not having currency a good thing or a bad thing? It was neither. It was necessary. Was their bad time in Paris a good thing or a bad thing? Neither.
It was necessary. Was that 5-hour gas leak good or bad? It was necessary that everything that happened on our paths to meet one another were all necessary. It had to happen the way it happened. And I say to each and every one of you, you look at everybody who's here at this meeting today. It's no accident. It's all necessary. It's all necessary because God knows the people we need. He knows where we need to be, and He knows what we need in order for us to be useful, to be of maximum service to Him and my fellow man. This is no accident. I was supposed to come back here 8 years later to meet the people, to meet Lefty and to meet Elton and see Michael and her husband Ted and to meet you. And for whatever reason I'm here, I'll probably find out and realize it about a month or two now. It'll be something that somebody says before or after this meeting that'll stick with me, that'll help improve my life. And if you're new 6 months or less, I want to make you a promise. I promise you, as sure as we're here today, that if you make AA and staying sober the most important thing in your life, everything will be taken care of for you. You won't have to worry about money. You won't have to worry about a job. You won't have to worry about anything. Of course you will, but it's part of spiritual growth. Thank you.